Good to see everyone so bright-eyed and cheery-faced after last night. The James Morrison and Barry Rafe show. High-class entertainment. At lunch today, an issue of critical importance to the future of your profession, Rod Cameron and Peter Harrington from ANOP Research Services will be here to discuss the results of a plebiscite of members on the proposal by Council to amend the definition of actuary to include associates. After that, Trevor Thompson will then announce details of how the Council intends to act on these recommendations contained in the plebiscite from you, the members. So that's the feature of lunch today. Evaluation forms, I've mentioned it a few times, but they're in your satchel. They're very important in terms of planning future conferences, and also getting an idea of how people responded to the events held. So they're in your satchels. And if you'd hand them to the registration desk, that'd be great. And just as we get things going this morning, and in particular we're going to focus in this plenary on professional leadership, so I think it's a subject which is really an interesting one, particularly in these critical times, to finish the conference on in terms of the formal part of the plenaries. Let me introduce Peter Doyle, who's the president-elect of the South African Institute or Society of Actuaries, to talk about the International Congress of Actuaries in South Africa next year. So, Peter, welcome.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here. And I'd first of all like to say thank you to the Council of the Institute in Australia for inviting me to this convention. It's been a great experience, and certainly last night I saw a new side of actuaries in Australia. So it's certainly been a stimulating experience, a worthwhile experience being here. And in turn, it's my pleasure to invite all of you to the International Congress of Actuaries in Cape Town in 2010. We'll be shortly screening a video, a DVD, on the Congress. But just to make a couple of points, I think it was very interesting yesterday that the minister who spoke at lunch, I think Minister Sherry, said that the international actuarial profession is one of the few really effective international professions. And I think the IAA is starting to really develop that very strongly. And what's very interesting to me, it's no surprise that the underlying theme of this convention has been the global financial crisis. And I think, as we all know, in the next 2 or 3 years, there's going to be a significant amount of global regulation, global discussion. And so I think ICA 2010 is really well placed. Just to tell you the dates, the 7th to the 12th of March next year, so just 11 months' time. And so I think it's going to be a very interesting timing because a lot of the heat would have dissipated, a lot of the noise would have dissipated, and it'll be really the hard effort to reconstruct the global financial industry. And so I think the timing is going to be very effective. Obviously, at the Congress, we'll have streams focusing on all the practice areas, all the key practice areas, and including as a main focus of the Congress, both risk management and professionalism, which you're also going to hear about this morning. So I invite you all to come. I think it's going to be a fantastic occasion. The organization is running very effectively and smoothly at the moment. There's a lot of information available. If you're interested, you should look at the website, www.ica2010.com. We can also engage with you in correspondence if you're interested. I'll be at the international desk just after the session. You can leave your business cards with me. There's a lot of opportunity to communicate, to discuss, to find ways to get there, and I invite you. I think it'll be great. Please come and talk to me. Even if you just want to talk about cricket, that's also fine. We're talking about cricket again in South Africa. So thank you very much for this opportunity, and I hope you enjoy the DVD. Thank you very much.
Situated on the southeastern tip of Africa, at the foot of the iconic Table Mountain, Cape Town is one of the world's most beautiful cities. The city is a melting pot where East meets West in Africa, and the resulting blend is a fascinating mix of cultures and history. The International Association of Actuaries, an actuarial society of South Africa, invites you to attend ICA 2010, a 5-day congress to be held in Cape Town. This is the first time ICA will be held in Africa. Cape Town is home to South Africa's largest multinational life assurance companies, and has actuarial history dating back to 1883, when the first Life Assurance Society was founded in the city. Our Congress theme, United in Our Diversity, recognizes that actuaries are active in many fields and in many countries. The program is designed to meet the professional needs of every actuary attending the Congress, from the technical specialist to the executive. 8 subject tracks will be presented in varying formats, with input from actuaries, academics, and external experts. The program is being designed by an international panel with representatives from each IAA section and key IAA committees with a special focus on professionalism. And ICA 2010 will be an excellent opportunity to present and discuss your research in a multidisciplinary forum of actuarial professionals. The welcome reception will be a relaxed outdoor feast at the foot of the 12 Apostles mountain range, overlooking the pristine beaches of the Atlantic coastline. A perfect welcome to show off what Cape Town has to offer. The gala dinner promises the opportunity to experience something very African, with the venue situated outside the convention center. Guests will see another side of the host city. 5-day Congress will take place at the Cape Town International Convention Centre. The CTICC is ideally located on Cape Town's foreshore, in the central business district and within walking distance to many hotels, as well as the well-known V&A waterfront. Cape Town is easily accessible from all countries with direct overnight flights from Europe, the Americas, Asia and Australia. Cape Town in March is an ideal time to visit. There is a warm Mediterranean climate, and as Cape Town will be nearing the completion of their 2010 FIFA infrastructure, delegates will be able to see Cape Town at its finest. March also welcomes a feast of international events, including the scenic and challenging 106-kilometer Cape Argus Pick and Pay Cycle Tour, as well as the lively Cape Town International Jazz Festival, plus the new Cape Town Carnival. It's easy to see why Sir Francis Drake, when he circumnavigated the globe, described the Cape Peninsula as the fairest cape of them all. The Mother City offers a wonderful lifestyle and diverse range of activities and attractions. There's the breathtaking Table Mountain with views across the city and the sea. A lazy day spent sampling world-class food and wine in the beautiful winelands, arguably the most scenic wine region in the world. An emotional visit to Robben Island, the World Heritage Site 10 kilometers off the coast, where Nelson Mandela and many leaders in the struggle for democracy were incarcerated. The V&A waterfront with its vibrant retail and entertainment areas, set in a picturesque commercial harbour. The Two Oceans Aquarium, which showcases the incredible diversity of marine life. The trip to and from Cape Point, following the spine of the peninsula to breathe in some of the freshest air on the planet, straight from the Antarctic. And Kirstenbosch Botanical Gardens, on the slopes of Table Mountain, a wonderful showcase of the unique diversity of the world-renowned Cape Floral Kingdom. Before or after the Congress, don't miss the opportunity to enjoy some of Southern Africa's greatest destinations. South Africa is a land of great diversity and beauty, featuring tropical coastlines and arid deserts, carpets of dazzling daisies, and Big Five safaris. We take conservation seriously and lead environmental protection in Africa. Even if you only have 2 or 3 extra nights, a trip to the bush is an amazing and distinctly African experience. Meeting Mother Nature face to face in the form of the wildest animals is an experience you and your family will never forget. If you have always dreamed of hearing the roar of the majestic Victoria Falls, or of climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, or of paddling through the Botswana Okavango Delta, consider South Africa your gateway to Africa, and make your dreams come true.
I'd like to welcome you all to come to South Africa for the Congress of Actuaries in 2010. this is a time of opportunity and development for the profession in this part of the world. Also, it's an opportunity for a young and vibrant profession in Africa to show how they can lead the world in terms of a wonderful program of professional and social and scientific events which will really attract the population of actuaries who will come here. So come to Cape Town and make it a priority to be here in March 2010.
I'm not sure which of the things that I'm enjoying most, but I've already started planning for my next paper.
And there's been quite a few good presentations, both at the plenaries, which I think have been excellent.
I quite enjoy the plenary sessions. I think they've been quite informative, great overviews of things, and very interesting, yeah. So.
The main thing I think I'm getting out of the conference is that actuaries have a big part to play in the current market financial crisis.
Well, I find that these Australian conferences are always really well run, and you get some great plenary speakers.
The addition of what I would call non-actuaries to the convention has been a great stimulating thought process.
For me, it's just been interesting to see an alternative perspective on some of the issues that I've been looking at in my studies as a health economist as well.
Oh, it's been the first time I've been to one of these, and it was great just meeting up with all the people I've come across over many years in the industry, so that's probably been the highlight.
This is my first time, and so I think, I'm quite surprised by all the research that's actually happening and all the ideas that's been going around, so I find it quite inspiring, actually.
This is my first conference as well, and I just thought it was very interesting how we could how actuaries in general could participate in policy debates from the couple of ministers of parliament that we've had during lunch.
Some sort of funky costume, but for the gala dinner later?
Well, given that we're sponsoring the dinner, I will be dressed in my finest James Bond attire, which, I'll leave it to your imagination to figure out what it is, but it's either Bond girl or your favourite James Bond look, so.
I think the Bond girl would be more fun.
Possibly for others, not for me.
Well, I did tell a couple of people in my office that I was expecting at least one of the girls to come painted gold.
Coming to as M, but I just have the wrong colour hair.
My name's Bond, James Bond.
I don't know, it's difficult for me to find a Bond character that I could go with other than Halle Berry, but I think I was the wrong gender for that. So.
Well, I don't think I look very good in a bikini, but one thing I did think about is maybe I could carry a martini.
I'm just going to go with a dark suit, a white shirt, and a tie, which is what James Bond wore. So. When he was clothed.
But don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. For a golden girl knows when he's kissed her. It's the kiss of death from Mr.
Well, 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 look what the cat dragged in. A sea of James Bonds and pussy galore.
Because the thing about me, we wander through life aimlessly. We don't have a plan for anything, really. I didn't plan on getting old. I didn't plan on being bald. I didn't plan on being an embarrassment to my kids.
Is cold. He loves
James Bond, eat your heart out. What fun. Well, now to this last of the plenary sessions, and the theme is professional leadership. And our three speakers are Clarence Da Gama Pinto, John Trowbridge, and Alden Taves. And let me just outline that each will talk for about 20 minutes and then we'll have time for a discussion. Firstly, Clarence, and he's going to talk about professional leadership in turbulent times, a slight revamp of what had been the original thought of theme, which was making a difference through increased personal effectiveness. So as he thought about it, he wanted to focus on the turbulent times and the opportunities these things create. Clarence specialises in leadership and customised management programs. He's worked extensively in Europe, North America and Asia in publishing, major event management and executive education. These days he presents on leadership for Melbourne Business School's Executive MBA and is responsible for the MBA Leadership Skills Workshop. Clarence works on programs for a range of clients too, including Hilton Asia Pacific, Macquarie, Pfizer, Laminex, Fletcher Building, GM Holden, Leighton Contractors and the ASX. He has a particular interest in global leadership and cross-cultural management development because his own story is a cross-cultural one. His ancestors come from Goa. He says he was educated by the Jesuits in Mumbai for 4 years. He was born in Kenya, where he lived about 11 years, I believe. Spent 20 years in the UK, 4 years in China, and now 20 years in Australia. So you can see why the theme of cross-cultural leadership and management appeals to him. Please welcome Clarence Da Gama Pinto.
Thank you, Peter. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I often throw in this idea of being educated by Spanish Jesuits, just in case you think I'm a little crazy, and it's just a way out. Blame the Spanish Jesuits, anyway. My topic is about professional leadership, and I've just got 20 minutes to talk on a subject which, after love, is the second most written topic in the world, so bear with me. Ladies and gentlemen, some of the questions that I'd like to pose to you is, I'm sure in the forefront of your mind, is what are the challenges facing you as a professional leader in the current global financial crisis? I think this is a really important contextual question. What are some of the skills, knowledge, and attitudes required to excel as a professional leader? How can you, as an individual, improve your effectiveness as a leader so that you can extend your influence across the organization community? I'll attempt to provide a perspective on these complex questions. As I said, due to time constraints, what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on what I do believe is the 20% that can make 80% of the difference for you as a professional leader. Let's start with your strengths. Technically brilliant, highly educated, and on top of your agenda. On top of your data and portfolio. Paradoxically, this is what has got you to where you are today, but it is not enough to get you to where you may wish to be at in 2 to 5 years from now. This is especially true for those of you who aspire to be leaders. You will need to become less data dependent and not fret that you do not have a complete grasp of the facts as you set out to deal with problems. I know this sounds like heresy, but hear me out. If you wish to be a leader, you need to embrace new behaviors and new ways of doing things. You will have to engage differently. Now, contemporary leadership is fraught with stories and feelings of loneliness at the top. It's not glamorous. Well, most of the time it isn't anyway. Leadership is also about disappointment, betrayal, continuous criticism, carping, and hostile skepticism. It's tough being a leader these days. As a leader, you're like an actor on stage, with the unrelenting spotlight focusing on your actions. Some of us may see ourselves as being bigger than Ben-Hur, noble of intent, courageous, decisive. Others may view our behavior differently. Their perceptions of us could well be one of Attila the Hun or Genghis Khan in full throttle. People judge you on what you do, not on your intentions. From a cross-cultural perspective, being a leader in Australia is more challenging than in most countries because we are an informal and disrespectful culture, and we have a democratic egalitarian streak in us. Being a leader in this cultural context is like walking a tight rope. You're expected to demonstrate vision and direction, but too much of this, and the tall poppy scissors will swing into action. You're also expected to be a mate. Too much mateship, and you'll be taken advantage of. It is very challenging to be a leader and a manager here. One could argue that leadership is a choice. We're all called to lead, irrespective of our position, but few of us actually choose to lead. In the current corporate world, the higher you go, I would argue that leadership capability is seen as a prerequisite. I don't think so you're going to have a choice to be a manager or a boffin somewhere just doing research, but you're going to be asked to lead, especially if you're very good at what you do. It takes a lot of courage and negotiation to remain an independent researcher or revenue generator these days. If the first challenge in every graduate's life is to learn how to be a professional, and I assume there are lots of graduates here, there comes a time for many of you attending this convention when you must learn how to lead other professionals. David Meister, who's the author of Through Professionalism and also Trusted Advisor, asserts, winning power to lead professionals is no easy task. Before a leader can be accepted, let alone succeed, autonomous professionals must agree to be influenced by that person. Your challenge is to get that agreement amongst your peers in an environment filled with much skepticism, change, and uncertainty. A savvy leader asks, why would anyone want to be led by me? This is an introspective question that involves some deep tissue work and calls on us to be reflective. Reflection does not come easily to most of us. As we rise through the ranks, it is our doing and deciding that gets us promoted. Doing and deciding, code words for crisis management, processing information with speed, and action becomes very addictive, with little time for reflection. There is hardly any time to answer these questions. Can things be done better? Should I do these tasks, or should I delegate them to others so that I can look at new opportunities out there? This is a critical skill for professional leaders in turbulent times. As a professional leader, you need to free yourself up to be on the business and not in the business. You have to make time to lead. You need to arrest time to develop people so that you can lead better, but most importantly, so that you can also prepare them for leadership. It's essential that you become visible and accessible to your staff. As a pracademic, a person who engages with the applied practical world of business and borrows from academia, I'm amazed at one of the missing pieces in a professional leader's repertoire. The missing piece is the chronic failure to understand or appreciate the differences between leadership and management. Professor John Cotter, a very distinguished professor from Harvard Business School, has made a useful distinction between leadership and management. Management is about planning and budgeting, organizing and staffing, controlling and problem solving, which produces a degree of predictability and order. It's about technical excellence, keeping the organization ticking over effectively and efficiently. One could argue that management and professionalism have much in common. It is about the pursuit and maintenance of technical excellence. But leadership is very, very different. It is about establishing direction, the vision thing, but I really prefer goal clarity, and lots of goal clarity for our teams. It is about aligning people in clear and credible ways. Not only the people who populate the organizational structural boxes, but the people in between who may not look like you or may come from different backgrounds. And it is about motivating and inspiring. A fundamental act of leadership, a very important part of leadership, is actually energizing your direct reports by removing obstacles in their way to doing good work. It's about factoring the human need for achievement, recognition, and self-esteem. The outcome of good leadership or professional leadership, as Cotter argues and I truly believe in, is often dramatic and useful change, new products that customers want, new liberating ways of doing things. Leadership is not for the risk-averse or faint-hearted. It might explain why most of us console ourselves by being managerial or professional in the narrow sense. Why? Because we can measure outcomes. We can operate below the radar, and we get rewarded for not breaking the budget. This helps explain why some of us feel overmanaged and underled. Effective leadership or professional leadership can be a beacon of hope in the current financial crisis. This is not to denigrate management in any way, as you cannot be an effective leader without some well-developed management competencies. But what professional leadership can offer us is revealed in the style of the leader. Why is style important? Because it sets the organizational tone or culture. Your style is your calling card. It is the compass or the barometer of your influence. Our world is replete with very, very bright people with off-the-chart IQ scores. I'm sure they populate all the room here. This room is also filled with passionate professionals who have spent years of study to consolidate a formidable range and magnitude of knowledge. But in this competitive and turbulent world, I would argue that these are threshold competencies necessary to get us to the game, but not into the thick of leadership action. But there is more. What we need more of these days is what we can call the distinguishing competence of star performers, and that's emotional intelligence. Often derided as soft skills, paradoxically, this is the hardest for most of us in this room. EQ is about making sense of our emotions and using emotions to inform our decision-making and to lead people in productive ways. Daniel Goleman, who has done much to popularize the concept of emotional intelligence and is currently the author of a very new book called Social Intelligence, argues that is what a leader does that can drive a climate to be productive or unproductive, happy or despondent. He identifies six leadership styles associated with emotional intelligence, which we can access depending upon the situation. There's the visionary authoritative style, authoritative, not authoritarian, but authoritative style, which is recommended for leaders who have to lead other professionals. This calls for clear direction, but that is firm but fair, and where the leader motivates by persuasion and constructive feedback. There's the democratic leadership style that is participative. There's the coaching style, which is developmental. And then there's the affiliative style, which puts the people first, where the leader puts people first, where the leader does little things and big things for their people and goes out of his or her way to be liked. However, there are two other styles that deserve a cautionary approach. There is the pace-setting style, where the leader leads by example, motivates by setting high standards, and expects others to follow. While this is useful in the early stages of your career, an overuse of this pace-setting, do-as-I-do-now style at the level of a professional leader can also lead to demoralization and a lack of inclusiveness. My experience with actuaries and investment bankers over the years, especially those of you aspiring to be recognized as leaders, has been that they tend to overuse the pace-setting style, which can impact negatively on follower morale and therefore on organizational climate. It is also a cause of individual burnout. The other style, the coercive commanding style, do what I tell you, is more akin to my way of the highway, which also involves close control. While all these six leadership styles should be part of your repertoire, we strongly suggest, or the research strongly suggests, that you use the pace setting and commanding coercive style judiciously. We are living in unprecedented times where previous approaches cannot be unilaterally applied. Professor Paul Kirkbride, who is the CEO of Mount Eliza Executive Education, Melbourne Business School, puts it this way: the past and the future are increasingly separated by discontinuity. Both the what and the how are increasingly unknown, and the options are left open. all the more reason, good people, is for us as aspiring professional leaders, is to get off the treadmill and to reflect on how we can demonstrate more effective behaviors as leaders to meet the new challenges. We need to ask questions. What is leadership for? Don't be reticent to ask yourself, whom am I called to serve? Another very useful question is, do I want to make a difference? With your skills and knowledge, if you choose to make a difference, there are so many areas in society, such as more robust risk management frameworks, intergenerational issues, and sustainable futures, where your professional leadership can make a difference. A most disturbing contemporary corporate phenomenon is busyness that most of us cocoon ourselves in, which means that there is less time for our clients, direct reports, peers, and bosses. We seem to have become so absorbed in our busyness with our Blackberries and frenetic meetings, that we expect good leadership and high morale just to happen. A question I often ask fast-moving executives, as also executives that just focus on detail, why are you in such a hurry to catch the train? Surely there'll be another train at the station. This is a metaphorical question for those of us who think that one instant conversation, because of course we know everything, with a colleague will help them and the organization to move forward. Effective coaching and superior communication, which should be the hallmark of all professional and great leaders, requires many conversations over a period of time that will lead not only to improved outcomes, but also to enhanced relationships. Stop. Observe. Listen. Truly listen to your people. The best ideas come through the ears, the eyes, the guts, not through the mouth. Use them in that proportion. If we do not arrest this busyness and make time to lead our people, then we'll continue to face the developing irony that absenteeism is not the problem during economic downturns. Presenteeism is. Professor Don Iverson from the University of Wollongong predicts that people are more likely to turn up to work because they are concerned about their jobs. So unless they can't possibly go to work, they're going to be there because they don't want to put their jobs at risk. According to research conducted by Medibank Private, presenteeism costs the Australian economy $25 billion a year, four times the cost of absenteeism. And deflation is not only a phenomenon of economics. Downturn, or the current R recession coming our way, causes employee deflation. They reduce employee engagement. Recent research by the Corporate Leadership Council shows that the number of highly disengaged employees has increased from 1 in 10 to 1 in 5 since the first half of 2007. While intent to stay remains the same as 3 years ago, the number of employees exhibiting discretionary effort has dropped by half. So how do we build morale in these difficult times? How do we encourage our people to give us this discretionary effort? How do we get them to go the extra mile for us in this tough economic climate? Relational leadership offers us a tool. This is the 20% I alluded to. Leadership does not have to consist of grand gestures or dizzy plans. Leadership can be in a suggestion. It does not have to be a grand Obama moment, but it often reflects ordinary people doing extraordinary things. Relationships at the heart of leadership. A much-needed competence for professional leadership, certainly at senior levels, is building, mending, and maintaining relationships. This competence is ranked as the number one developer need for senior executives based on the Benchmarks 360 research from the world-renowned Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro, North Carolina. I often ask my participants who attend our programs, look around you. In your bid to get to the top, have you left a trail of bruised, battered, and unhappy people? People will judge you on your track record and will follow you based on what you have done, not on your proposed manifesto should you get the job. Interestingly, but perhaps not fair, is the fact that you will be remembered for the 5 or 10% of the time when you lost your cool or were not at your best. Trust can be lost by just one uncontrolled outburst. In my world, leadership is about the quality relationships that I have in place to get the task done. Most Western managers are quite brilliant at planning and formulating policy, but they do not get the results they deserve due to failure to consider the vital role that emotions play in the change process. Very often it is the people factor that gets left out. This is no more evident than in change initiatives. There's been some excellent work by the Boston Consulting Group that reminds us that we're not alone as leaders and that there is power in numbers if we involve our team in change initiatives. So, ladies and gentlemen, why are relationships important for men and women of your caliber, for professional leaders in this room? It is because relationships create a pathway through the organization. Through relationships, information is created and transformed. Intelligence is created and the organization's identity expands to include new stakeholders. Relationships reduce our fears of others, especially when we don't know much about them. People need to talk to each other, and your role as professional leaders or aspiring professional leaders is to create abundant opportunities where people can meet and engage. This is the heart of the knowledge organization, making the implicit or the tacit explicit through dialogue. This can only be done if there's trust and good relationships in place. Just in talking about relationships, how have you used your time at this convention? Have you used this convention, a marvelous opportunity to engage with a variety of people? Or have you just gravitated to the people who look like you, or the same age, or the same backgrounds? Have you networked well? Have you communicated with and encouraged some of the younger attendees? This is what relational leadership is about.
3 minutes, Grant.
And you cannot do leadership, and you cannot do the leadership thing all by yourself. The days of heroic leadership, rugged individualism, and masculinities in the workplace are numbered. You have to find ways of engaging the group in coming up with leadership strategies that will enable you and them to achieve organizational goals. As I said, you cannot do it by yourself. And it's very unfair to expect the leader to do everything by themselves. There is wisdom and there is knowledge in the group. You need to get the group also to take responsibility for leadership actions. You'll also need to surround yourself with your own personal war cabinet or your own personal board of directors, trusted advisors. Make sure that they're not carbon copies of you. One of my observations of Australian companies is that we have a tendency not to take our bosses seriously. On the whole, we prefer them to leave us alone. Despite our irreverence for authority, it is important to build and maintain good relationships with our bosses. Remember that bosses have needs too. At the heart of professional leadership is the development of self-awareness. This will certainly help you to get through the current challenging crisis. Do you have a good sense of your strengths and your points of development? Do you just focus on your deficits? This will not boost your self-confidence. As a professional leader in your organization or your division, you have to have a compelling story. You need to have a compelling story to tell, and critically important is, do you live that story? Developing your leadership story is about telling people about your vision, your hopes, your expectations of them, your operational style, your likes and dislikes. Try not to leave your followers second-guessing about your leadership attitudes and aspirations. You need to communicate with infectious enthusiasm, and you need to demonstrate infectious enthusiasm in the way you communicate. And a good dose of humility will see you through these tough times too. Some of you will be familiar with level 5 leadership from the Good to Great research, with a clear call for focus and humility at the top. I'm at the end now, and so what I'm going to say to you, I'm certainly not here to offer you answers. I think anyone who offers you a formula to lead as a charlatan. Why? Because in this day and age, you can attend leadership programs, you can read great books, but one thing is certain is that you will leave these programs, or after reading these books, you will leave more knowledgeable, but you will leave with even greater uncertainty. This is the role of complexity and ambiguity in the world we live in. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, I do believe in the words of Mahatma Gandhi, you can be the change in this world. Leadership starts with you, and you have to discover new ways of leading, including leading up. If you're waiting for your boss or your organization or firm to change, then you are only cheating yourself. There's lots of help at hand. You have the Institute of Actuaries of Australia, the Step Up program, supported passionately by Andrew Gale and his colleagues. You have good professional leaders in the room. There's Andrew Brown of AXA, lots of excellent people here. There's lots of help at hand. As Nelson Mandela emphasizes in his presidential inaugural address, the world cannot afford for you to play small. Thank you for your attention, and remember, the choice to lead is yours.
Thanks, Dave.